So tonight's talk starts with a question. And some of you have heard me ask this question before, so you don't get the answer. What were the Buddha's last words?
Strive on.
Strive on. Anything else?
Something about a lamp unto yourself.
Be a lamp unto yourself. Any other guesses? Okay, the be a lamp unto yourself could also be translated as be an island unto yourself. The word is dipa, which can mean both. But he didn't say that the night he died. He said that several months before. What he said was, all the things of creation are subject to decay. Diligently seek liberation. Translating a bit loosely. So another question. Kandanya knew, right? Remember when I told you about at the end of the first sermon, Kandanya knew. What was it he knew? All that arises also ceases. And so, anicca was a big theme in the Buddha's teachings from the very beginning until literally the very end. When we first hear of the three characteristics of anicca, dukkha, anatta, inconstancy, unsatisfactoriness, and corelessness, it's like, okay, everything changes. Yeah, I guess so. You know, we get that one. And then dukkha. Everything is dukkha? Nah, those brownies weren't dukkha. Right? So that doesn't really make sense. And then, actually, anatta is literally not self. No. That just doesn't make any sense at all. Because it's me sitting here. Who else would it be? But I got the first one, right? Everything changes. Well, if you really got the anicca part, you'd get the other two as well. It's far more profound than we really appreciate at first glance. There are a huge number of suttas where the Buddha's pointing out the anicca nature of reality and how important it is to pay attention to the fact that everything is changing. There's a story, it's not from the suttas. It's about a king. And when he came to power, he said, those who give me presents at my coronation will be considered for ministerial positions. And whoever gives me the most powerful present will be the prime minister. And so people brought all sorts of presents. The previous prime minister under the old king brought an elephant. And everybody figured, he'll get to keep his job. But then a jeweler comes up, and he's got a little box, and he says, be careful, Your Majesty. This has the power to make you sad when you're happy, as well as the power to make you happy when you're sad. The king was, of course, very intrigued, and he opened the box and pulled out a ring. And written around it was, this too shall pass. He got to be the prime minister. Everything is changing. We've already talked about how you can't breathe except for the fact that it's changing. Your heartbeat is due to things changing. This is what there is. There is only change. We couldn't digest without change. And yet, people are afraid of change. They're afraid that their old familiar way of doing something just won't be there anymore. What they're really afraid of is that they won't be able to cope when things change. I sometimes tell people, you can't make the ocean go flat, but you can learn to surf. And that's basically what we're after in this world of change. Change is everywhere. Why does time go in one direction only? I mean, I can get up, I can walk over to the door, and I can walk back. Right? So I can go forwards and backwards in space. But why does time only go forwards? Seemed like a very curious thing. You find scientific papers writing about it. They usually talk about entropy. But, you know, why doesn't it go backwards? And where exactly is the past? And where exactly is the future? Well, if you look really carefully, it turns out there's no such thing as time. It's a completely made-up phenomena. The past is your memory, and we know how good that is. And the future, that's your fantasy. And it's highly unlikely it's going to turn out like your fantasy. All there really is the present. The ever-changing present. It's not the eternal now. It's the ever-changing now. The fact that it's always changing, we notice that. And we do notice that some of the changes happen periodically, like the sun coming up. And so in an attempt to measure these regular changes, we invent time. But it's not real. It's just a thing that we make up. What's really there is change. Time is an emergent property of change. It emerges from our attempt to measure it. And this also explains why time only goes in one direction. Things don't unchange. Now, it's true, I could pick up my glasses case and put it on the other side of the table, and then I could pick it up and put it back where it was, and so the glasses case unchanged. But all those cars out there on I-5 didn't go backwards when I moved the glasses case back, right? It really wasn't an undoing of a change, it was just changing to be like it used to be. There's just all this change. And so since things don't unchange, time doesn't go backwards. It's just changing. And our attempt to measure it leaves us with this sometimes conundrum of time going in only one direction. Another way you can do walking meditation is to take a walk outside of time. I particularly like doing this when I go for a walk and I don't have to particularly pay careful attention to the roots in the trail or anything like that. And I don't have to pay careful attention about navigating my way back to wherever I started from. And the idea is that you go for a walk and you don't let yourself perceive time. You see a bird changing its position in the sky. You see a tree that's horizontal and you know it used to be vertical. You don't think about the past. You don't imagine the future. You're just staying there noticing change. It's kind of tricky to do this. But if you're really paying attention, you can walk along and all that's happening is change is taking place. In fact, when it goes really well for me, what I find is if I'm walking down the road, eventually it starts that I'm just picking up my feet and the road's going by underneath. I'm not walking along the road. As I pick my feet up, the road goes by. It's just changing because in the visual field, everything is changing. It appears to be coming at me and disappearing. This walking outside of time is, well, it's a nice concentrating practice and it's another way to do walking meditation when you're walking back and forth. But it's also a very good thing to do when you're going for a walk. You're free to pay attention to everything around you. Just don't get caught in thinking about the future or the past. Just notice that there's a lot of change going on. Change is ubiquitous. It's just everywhere. I brought a little book here entitled Budescence. It was written by Daryl Bailey. Daryl was a monk with Ajahn Sumedho in England for about a dozen years. And then he disrobed and came back to Canada, and he wrote this little book on what he felt was the essence of Buddhism. And he did a pretty good job. There's a lot of interesting stuff in this very little book. The first chapter, he goes through the suttas, and he picks out basically passages from the suttas that he figures are really the essence of what the Buddha was teaching. And these passages reflect the Buddha's emphasis in noticing and experiencing the change that's going on all the time. So basically what Daryl did was get a bunch of things from the suttas, pull them out of context, and write a commentary. And mostly he did pretty good. There's occasionally I go, that's not what that means, Daryl. But mostly I'm giving him two thumbs up on this. So what I want to do is just simply share the suttas, not his commentary. Although I definitely recommend getting a copy of this book. And yes, it's on the reading list on my website. But just the sutta passages that he thought were quite important. There will come a time when even the mountains and the earth itself will be gone. All things are impermanent, unstable, and insecure. Although it is of great benefit to feed Buddhas, to feed the monastic community, to build monasteries, to follow moral precepts, and to practice loving kindness, it is of more benefit to maintain the perception of impermanence. It is better to live a single day perceiving how things rise and fall than to live a century not perceiving this. Everything is changing. Not even as much as a pinch of dust is unchanging. Physical forms, vedana, perceptions, mental activities, and consciousness, all of these arise, pass away, and while they are present, they change. They are insubstantial, without essence. Physical form is like a lump of froth. Vedana are like a water bubble. Perception is a mirage. Mental activities are like the empty banana tree trunk. And consciousness, a magician's trick. Now, these are the five aggregates, these five things. Form, vedana, perception, mental activities, and consciousness. This is our experience. This is all that we ever experience. Sometimes we experience physical form. When we get a sense impression, we get a vedana. And then we identify what that sense impression is. And then there's the mental activities, all the thoughts and everything that happens. And all of it's happening because we're conscious. The mental activities are actually the largest part of our life. They have done studies and they find that 80% of our mental activities arise from our mental activities. Only 20% of our mental activities arises from the five senses input. We're spending far more time thinking about what we're experiencing than actually experiencing. And yet the Buddha says these five aggregates, these five heaps, are changing all the time. And furthermore, they are insubstantial without essence. Physical form is like a lump of froth. Your body is physical form. A lump of froth doesn't stick around all that long. Vedana are like a water bubble. The actual simile that's given is when it's raining hard and rain hits a pool of water and this bubble comes up. Well, how long does that bubble stay? How long do your Vedana stay? Those brownies, they produce pleasant Vedana for how long? I mean, you take a bite, it feels really pleasant for what, 5 minutes? Well, no, maybe not. Maybe a minute? No, maybe like 5 seconds, 10 seconds. Then you're on to the next bite, trying to get another hit of pleasant. Vedana come and go really rapidly.
What was that analogy for
Vedana? A water bubble with raindrops falling in a puddle of water. Perception is like a mirage. Did you ever misperceive anything? Right? Okay. Our perception is basically our attempt to take the holistic universe and chop it into bits and pieces so we can deal with it. Our little pea brains aren't big enough to take it all in. And so in order to get it into bite-sized chunks, we take the holistic input and we divide it up. And this is a clock, and this is a glass of water, and that's a timer, and this is a book. All right, and we're chopping it up. But what's really interesting is that when we chop it up like this, when we conceptualize the bits and pieces, we then are working with the concepts much more than the actual experience that's out there. Once we've named it, we're manipulating the names much more than we're manipulating the actual environment. Mental activities are like the empty banana tree trunk. Ever chop down a banana tree? You know, you get a nice big thick trunk like this and you get your machete and in one good whack you can cut it in two. It's hollow. You can just unroll it, and as you unroll it, nothing there. This is your mental activities, your thoughts, your emotions, and your memories. Hollow, empty like the banana tree trunk. And consciousness is a magician's trick. Nothing really is very substantial going on. Life is like a flowing river, never pausing for a moment, an instant, or a second. There is an unformed happening. It is ignorance of the unformed that gives rise to formations. Okay, so life is like an ever-flowing river, never pausing for a moment, an instant, or a second. This is reminiscence of Heraclitus. You can't step in the same river twice. But the river isn't just a river out there. It's the river of life. It's just flowing on, and it's never stopping and never the same. The universe out there is really unformed, unconceptualized. And yet, in order to deal with it, we need to conceptualize it. So ignorance of the holistic nature of the universe leads to us conceptualizing it and then believing the concepts are what's really there. To believe that there is permanence, that is, formations, in the impermanent, the flowing, is a distortion of perception, thought, and view. I heard a talk by Joseph Goldstein one time, and he said that you should think of yourself not as a noun, but as a verb. And I thought that was actually quite brilliant. I mean, we are much more verb than noun. There's the circulatory process and the digestive process, and we're a collection of processes. And yeah, that's a much better way of looking at ourselves as a verb rather than a noun. And then I begin exploring the rest of the universe. And what I found was there aren't any nouns. It's just verbs moving kind of slow. Right? Right now, this is tabling, right? Well, I guess unless you're a leprechaun, then it's a telephone booth, bus shelter, right? But we call it a table. Used to be trees. Somebody chopped down the trees, made the wood into this shape. Somebody connected it all together. Somebody bought it, hauled it in here, and now it's a table. And someday it'll probably break, and then it'll be firewood. And then it'll be carbon dioxide breathed in by some more trees. Mother Nature's just running a big recycling project, and we're part of what gets recycled. It's all verbs, but some of it's moving kind of slow. Well, actually, no. When I looked really carefully, I saw that there was only one verb, unfolding. Not the unfolding, because that makes it more of a noun. There's just the universe unfolding, but it's really just unfolding. That's all there is. And this is what the Buddha's pointing to, that yeah, in order to deal with the unfolding, we need to chop it up into trees and houses and doors and my bed and my shoes and your shoes and all this other stuff. But these are just concepts that we're laying on top of what's really there. What's really there is simply this vast unfolding. Interesting side note, the Navajo language doesn't have any nouns. Okay, so you wouldn't be a person, you would be personing, right? And this is tabling, and this is chairing. You might get a much closer, better, more accurate picture of reality if you learn Navajo, which I'm told is one of the more difficult languages to learn. But it gives you a way of breaking out of the way we usually look at the world, to look at it as verbs, and then to look at the fact that, yeah, it's all verbs and they're all interconnected and there's just this big unfolding, this flowing. A young infant does not have an idea of a self, things, rites and rituals, sensual pleasures, and beings. A young infant does not have ideas of a body, speech, or intention. When a baby's born, it has no clue what's going on. There's just all this input. Things arise and they disappear and they come back, and some of them are pleasant and some of them are unpleasant. They're experiencing the world much more in terms of verbs, in terms of just there's this unfolding. And it takes time for them to begin to distinguish themselves from their mother and see that, you know, when something disappears, it didn't really disappear. Can move their head and it comes back, this sort of stuff. Yet the underlying tendency to develop self-views, rites and rituals, sensual desire, and ill will lies within the infant. When he grows and his faculties mature, he plays at games. When he grows and his faculties mature further, the youth enjoys himself with sensual pleasures of formations, sights, sounds, smells, taste, and textures. On seeing a physical form, he wants it if it is pleasing and dislikes it if it is displeasing. Absorbed in liking and disliking, he clings to any feeling he feels. On hearing a sound, smelling a smell, tasting a flavor, touching a texture, noticing a mental object, there is clinging. So we go from just this buzz and whirl of experience to identifying objects, recognizing that some objects produce pleasant vedana, although we don't use the term pleasant vedana, and that we want to get those, and we desire them, and when we get them, we cling to them, and we see others produce unpleasant vedana, and we push them away and try and keep them away. We've made a world of objects that we can deal with, and we're no longer actually experiencing the holistic nature of the universe. Birth is origin, descent into the womb, delivery, the appearance of the five groups of formations, that is, the five aggregates, form, vedana, perception, mental activities, and consciousness, and the functioning of the sense faculties around these five aggregates. One is called a being when firmly entangled in desiring physical forms, vedana, perceptions, mental activities, and consciousness. So we've now taken our experience and we're dividing it up into that's material and that's which conceptual and that's which ideas and everything else. These five focuses of clinging create dukkha. When one sees that the desire for physical forms, vedana, perceptions, mental activities, and consciousness, when a man has desire for these, then when they change, sorrow, pain, and despair arise in him. This is the cause of dukkha. This desire arises when things appear to be enjoyable and ultimately fulfilling. So we find something pleasant, and if it's not ours, we want to get it, that's craving. And if we get it, we want to keep it, and that's clinging. And what the Buddha is saying is this can lead to dukkha, that dukkha arises dependent on that craving and clinging. There are four kinds of clinging. Clinging to sensual pleasures, clinging to views, clinging to self-theories, clinging to rites and rituals. So clinging to sensual pleasures. So you obtain something that gives you pleasant whatever, a painting, and it's beautiful, a photograph, it's nicely framed. Right? This is giving you sensual pleasures, a pan of brownies. Clinging to views, we're trying to make sense of this world that we find ourselves embedded in. Somebody earlier said they didn't remember signing up for this. Yep, you've still found yourself here, and you got to deal with it. And so we try and understand what's going on by basically telling ourselves a story about why things are happening the way they do. Now, what's unfortunate is that some of these stories that we're telling ourselves, we hatched up when we were 3, 4, 5, 8 years old. And we didn't really have a clue what was going on. In particular, if we're in a stressful environment when we're a little kid, it's too scary to realize that the people that are supposed to be taking care of us don't have a clue. And so when things go wrong, it's less scary to think, it's my fault. Somehow I can do better and make it better. But that taking it on ourselves and saying, it must be my fault. Well, we've got this view and then we're stuck with it. And now we're 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years old, and we're still operating on this view that we came up with in a stressful situation when we were 5 years old. And it gets to be so bad that we have to go pay somebody $100 an hour to help us let go of this 5-year-old view that no longer serves us. We cling to this stuff like crazy. When it gets in there early, it's really hard to let go of. Clinging to self-theories. I didn't sign up for this. What am I doing here? How am I supposed to behave? What's going on? So this is like the ultimate view, is how do I fit into this whole madness that's unfolding around me? And we come up with ideas, and we cling to them, even when they no longer serve us. And clinging to rites and rituals. At the time of the Buddha, the dominant paradigm was Brahmanism. And as I mentioned, there was a lot of rites and rituals, particularly sacrifices, that needed to be done. And so people would cling to this stuff. To update it more, we could say clinging to superstitious beliefs. Or to update it even more, clinging to habits. Clinging to ideas of how things worked in the past, so we're going to keep on with that. We get stuck in these things from that we have found that seemed like they work, even if they had nothing to do with it, and we just hang on to them. So we laugh at the Brahmins with their silly sacrifices, but we do the same thing with our own habits. These are the kind of clingings that we have. Ignorance of the flowing quality of life gives rise to a tendency to fixate on formations, and this gives rise to sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. A wise disciple sees this and is no longer fascinated by physical forms, vedana perceptions, mental activities, and consciousness. So, let's say that you go to the beach and you take a little kid with you, right? And you build a sandcastle. Nice big sandcastle. Turrets, you got a drawbridge made out of some driftwood. Very cool sandcastle. And of course, sooner or later, a big wave comes along and wipes it out. The little kid might be screaming, totally upset, freaked out even. Are you upset? Are you freaked out? No. You understand the nature of sandcastles. In fact, that's sort of one of the cool things about sandcastles. You build this thing and then a big wave wipes it out, right? You don't think, oh, it's a great sandcastle. Hey, let's dig it up and put it in the trunk of the car. We'll take it home, put it on the dining room table. This doesn't occur to you. You have the understanding of the impermanent nature of sandcastles, so the idea of clinging to it does not arise. I got news for you, people. It's all sandcastles. This is what the Buddha's trying to point out to us. It's all changing. It's not as obvious as with the sandcastle. But we're acting like the three-year-old kid and expecting all these things that are subject to change to not get wiped out. But all that is mine, dear and delightful, will change and vanish. And we got to come to terms with that. This is what the Buddha is saying. See the impermanent nature. This doesn't mean you can't enjoy it while it's around. You enjoyed the sandcastle, right? It just means that you understand that sooner or later it's liable to get wiped out. Life is like a flowing mountain river, never pausing for a moment or an instant or a second. Perceiving impermanence in all formations, then formations will be seen as insubstantial, changing, not lasting. Perceiving impermanence, the mind does not reach for gain, for control. Knowing that physical forms, vedana, perceptions, mental activities, and consciousness are insubstantial, fading away, and ultimately unsatisfying, the attraction to these is given up. When you see it's all sandcastles, you don't get lost in trying to possess the newest and latest sandcastle. With no attachment to physical forms, vedana, perceptions, mental activities, and consciousness, then when they change, no sorrow, pain, grief, and despair arises. Perceiving no lasting formation, no mentality or materiality, the mind is rid of the conceit, I and mine, this body and consciousness. The mind with understanding is set free from the stain of sensual desire, the asava of sensual desire, the intoxicant of sensual desire, ideas of endless pleasure, the intoxicant of becoming, becoming something in this life, becoming something in a future life, the intoxicant of views, interpretations, and the intoxicant of ignorance, particularly ignoring the impermanent nature and ignoring the not-self nature of everything, including me. Supreme emptiness, liberation, is the presence of the six sensory feels, the happening of the moment, without the intoxicant of sensual desire, the intoxicant of becoming, and the intoxicant of ignorance. That which is absent, desire, self, world, and permanence, is known to be absent. That which is present, the happening of the moment, is present. Can you just rest in the sensory input that's happening without making a big deal about it, without reaching to grab hold of some sandcastle to take home? Can you just rest in what's going on? If you have a quiet enough mind, this is possible. Whoever in the past reached and remained in pure emptiness, liberation, it was this that they reached. By not clinging to views, by seeing life clearly, being freed from sense desires, one is not born again into delusion and clinging. So what are you clinging to? What impermanent sandcastle are you spending your time and energy trying to hang on to? A few summers ago, I had something happen that really brought this home to me. I was sitting on my couch reading a book, and there was a knock at the door, and I opened the door, and there were these two guys standing there. There was a tall, skinny one, and a sort of short, fat one, definitely on the plump side. They were wearing dark suits, white shirts, dark ties, and hats. The tall one whips out a badge and says, FBE, we've come for the socks. I was like, what? FBE, we've come for the socks. What on earth are you talking about? The little guy has a clipboard. He goes, Federal Bureau of Enlightenment. Didn't you sign up for enlightenment? Arhat, ambitious, aren't we? I was like, what are you guys talking about? And the little guy says, we know that in the upper right-hand drawer of your chest of drawers, in the back left-hand side, there are five socks that have holes in them, and we've come for those socks. What? We've come for the socks, those holy socks. You want the socks? Yeah. Wait here. I close the door. I locked the door. Okay, I didn't live too far from Berkeley then, but, you know, it was still kind of weird. I go upstairs. I open the drawer. Yeah, right in the back. Yeah, there's these socks I was going to fix. I'm never going to fix these socks. Okay. Go downstairs. Open the door. You want these socks? Yeah, thank you. They take the socks. They go away. It's like, is that the Blues Brothers? I mean, they sort of look like the Blues Brothers, but no. That was weird, man. Next day at work, I tell my friends about this. We all have a good laugh. You know, come home, sitting there the next day, and reading the book, same book, knock on the door. I look through the peephole this time. It's those same guys. Like, I wonder what they want this time. Well, if it's just holy socks, I don't have any more. So I open the door. Hello. FBE, we've come for the celery. The celery? Yeah, we know that in the left-hand crisper of your refrigerator, there are two stalks of celery that are 3 weeks old. Okay. You want that celery? Yes. Wait here. Close the door. Lock the door. Go in the kitchen. Open the crisper. Yep, I forgot about the celery. Yeah, they can have it. Oh, man. Give them the celery. They seem happy. They go away. This is really kind of weird. Oh, well. So, next day, I'm sitting on the couch. In the afternoon, it's a Saturday. And reading the book, different book now. And there's a knock at the door. It's like, okay, look at the people, it's them. This is really absurd. All right, so open the door. Yes, FBE, we've come for the couch. The couch, you can't have the couch. Go away. They look at me and they say, you're clinging to the couch. They go, yeah, darn right I'm clinging to the couch. That's where I sit when I read my book. You're clinging to the couch and you're going to let a couch get in the way of your enlightenment? I mean, you signed up for our hardship and you're going to let a couch stop you? You guys can't have the couch. Well, we go on like this for like 10 minutes. I was really amazed at the arguments they had. I mean, it was like, they did have a point. I mean, I was clinging to the couch. So finally I say, all right, you can have the couch. Now, to get the couch in and out of my apartment, there's a trick. I didn't tell them the trick. They figured it out. There goes my couch down the driveway. Bye-bye, couch. Right? Okay, next day, sitting in a chair, reading a book. There's a knock at the door. Look through the peephole. Not open this door. I don't know what they want this time. Same two guys, you know. I hear them knocking again. We know you're in there. Jeez. They just won't go away. I mean, it's like 5 minutes. They are like, come on, we know you're in there. Finally, I open the door. What? FBE. We've come for the hot tub. The hot tub? I snatched the clipboard out of the little guy's hands. There it is. Socks, celery, couch, hot tub, Prius, waterbed, girlfriend. Girlfriend! I shoved the clipboard back in their faces, push them out of the door, slam the door, lock the door. Leaning up against the door, my heart is pounding, my palms are sweating. Then I realized I'd made a really big mistake. I opened the door, they were only at the end of the driveway. I shouted after them, hey, hey, can I have my couch back? So what are you clinging to? What are you hanging on to? When the FBE comes knocking at your door, what are you not going to give them? Whatever it is, that's what you're clinging to. That's what's going to get in the way of your spiritual progress. There's a sutra in the Mahayana tradition. It's called the Diamond Cutter Sutra, sometimes referred to as the Diamond Sutra. Musang from the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies has a very good translation of this, along with a really excellent commentary. And the sutta builds, sort of like Bolero, you know, up to this high point. And the high point is this verse. Thus you should view this fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, a dream. All the things of creation are subject to decay. Diligently seek liberation. Any questions?
Earlier than they would have wanted to retire, and are too old to get any
to get another job. Yeah,
and don't have jobs available at the level that they previously earned, but they have a lot of life ahead of them, mortgages and families, and so and I also know people who are working for minimum wage who never imagined that they'd be working for minimum wage. And there's a lot of dukkha to these situations, and talking about letting go and impermanence doesn't land well.
Right. Yeah, the Buddha said there are few people with little dust in their eyes, okay? And when you're struggling for survival, yeah, I mean, I don't want to say you've got dust in your eyes, but there's a lot of things that are, yeah, just a little too hard to deal with, and you're more focused on survival, right? But I'm hoping that everybody in this room is not working at that level, and that you can hear that if you're clinging to impermanent things, you could be setting yourself up to experience something that will produce dukkha, and that all the things that you could possibly cling to are impermanent. So yeah, you may not be able to talk to these people about this sort of stuff.
Yeah, and if you're sharing the Dharma with people who...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to share at a level that can be heard. I'm figuring everybody in this room is at a more advanced level.
Does that mean that the Dharma is for privileged people?
No. It means that people need to be taught what they can hear given their circumstances. Right? And hopefully the circumstances for these people change to where they can hear something where they're not caught in the struggle for survival. Right? I mean, yeah, this is difficult. I have friends that are in the same position as you're describing. When you're 59 years old, nobody wants to hire you, and you can't retire because you don't have enough savings, and Social Security, even if you could get it, it's going to be too small, and it's a struggle. Yeah. So giving this talk to those people would not particularly be appropriate. But I'm hoping that it was appropriate for everybody in this room. But even for them, if they're reaching for something that's impermanent and isn't a matter of survival, then it's possible to point out that, yeah, this is not going to give you what you're expecting because it is impermanent.
But unless you become a monk and just give up everything, how do you do that?
Little by little. I mean, most of us have far more than we actually need, right? So what can you let go of? Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. And it applies, yeah, to all of us. So yeah, as a lay person, there are some things that you just gotta have. I mean, that's the way it is to make a living, to live in this world. But all of it is sandcastles. So don't be counting on these things to give you security. And the more that you can let go of, the more freedom that you find. This is just the way it works. So yeah, it's not that we have to get rid of everything at once. I mean, unless you're going to become a monastic. But in this culture, we're all suffering from affluenza, except for those people that are really struggling to survive. But the general person in this culture has far more than they need.
But some of us are able to come on this retreat because of that affluence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you can still probably find things to let go of. And the things you can't let go of, you need to be prepared for them to change and vanish. Because that can happen.
I feel like you're kind of focusing more than I would on material things. Mm-hmm. To me, the freedom is not that I get rid of my atap. You know, I don't think that will solve dukkha for me.
Right.
It's the clinging to self. It's the clinging to it's the wanting. It's the aversion. It's the mind states.
Right.
Rather than the things. And the things are, I think it's quite possible to be wealthy and not be attached. You know, harder maybe, but and you can get rid of all your stuff
and still
you'll have your dukkha, you know. Yeah. So it just feels to me like it's a little, let's not forget where the real suffering comes from.
The solution is in your attitude towards the stuff that's changeable, whether it be a friendship or relationship with a capital R or your hot tub. Okay? And it's, can you get your attitude so that you can deal with the fact that this stuff is subject to change, that it's impermanent? And I mean, Buddhism is basically about an attitude adjustment. You know, they used to have change your mind days. Yeah, that's what we're after. We're after changing our mind, changing our relationship to all the stuff, whether it be material or immaterial, that is subject to changing and vanishing. You have to get past it, yeah. Yeah, Blake talked about this, William Blake. He talked about innocence and experience and then experienced innocence. And that's sort of what we got to do. We come in all innocent and then we get enough experience, but if we stay there in the experience, we're clinging to these impermanent things and they change and we get upset. And then what we need is the experienced innocence where we can go back to having the attitude of using the stuff that's going to change and then not being freaked out when it does change. So yeah, you're exactly right. It's kind of a dirty trick. The things that you've got to learn in order to survive turn out to make things, well, not so good for you. You've got to get beyond the things that you had to learn to survive.
We are part of a society. Mm-hmm. So society is a network. And to be accepted and to be part of that network, there are some rules that you have to play in. So you kind of entangled in the network of expectations and judgments. Mm-hmm. And to play your piece in that puzzle, you have to stick to that.
To some extent. But I think there's a lot more freedom than we give ourselves credit for. I think it's possible to be in the society and, you know, feed the parking meters without getting totally entangled in what the society is promoting. It's not easy. I mean, if the spiritual path were easy, we'd all gotten enlightened a long time ago. And so it's again, you play by the rules, but you're not being fooled by the rules. It's an attitude adjustment that's really required.
Can you say more about consciousness being a magician's trick?
One of the hard questions in science is, what is consciousness? I mean, they just haven't figured out what it is. It seems like we ought to know because, well, it's there a lot. But we can't quite understand what's going on here. It's there, well, every time I'm conscious, but it goes away every night. Right? When you're in dreamless sleep, where did it go? It arises dependent on other conditions. It doesn't exist independent. And just like a magician's trick, it's not exactly what it seems to be. Does that help? It's tricky. Consciousness is, one of the real hard questions. I'll talk a little bit more about it not tomorrow night, not the next night, but the night after that. Right.
Which has a different meaning from what is talked about as consciousness most of the time.
Right. It's interesting, in the suttas, the word vijnana gets used in 4 or 5 different contexts to mean different things. Sometimes consciousness means the mind. Okay, it's synonymous with the mind. With the khandhas, it's usually interpreted to being sense consciousness. Sometimes it seems like that might be stretching things a little bit, but mostly that's what it is. There's consciousness as the sixth element. There's consciousness as conscious versus unconscious. There's consciousness as self-conscious. So we have all of these things there. In the khandhas, though, it mostly is referring to sense consciousness, I think. But it's sometimes a little hard to figure that out. And there's actually a sutta where the word vijnana gets used in 4 different ways in one short sutta. So, yeah, lots of confusion possible there. There's a book by Peter Harvey, I don't remember the name of it, on vijnana, consciousness in the Buddhist context, that I actually found quite interesting. But sorry, I don't remember the name.
Could you talk about some of the ways in your practice you've had the most profound experiences of the nature changing the world?
Well,
that's summer.
What? Yeah. Giving up the celery wasn't too bad. Giving up the salary was a little harder. I mean, 5.5 years ago, I quit my job. I said goodbye to my girlfriend. The relationship had reached that point where, yep, it was time for a change. And packed up my belongings, stuck them in a storeroom, and yeah, hit the road, basically, and I've been on the road ever since. So that particular move was a pretty dramatic change. Yeah, and it's still going on. And in some ways, it was, well, really, I was in culture shock for the first month. I went off to the forest refuge to meditate for 2.5 months, and the first month was basically culture shock. And the second month was grieving for the end of the relationship. So yeah, there was a lot of changes that came down there. But in many ways, it freed me up, and it's made my life, well, really quite amazing lately. So that was a profound change that came along. I don't know. Is that what?
I guess I was thinking more in terms of sort of practices, some of the Satipatthana contemplations, or some experiences of jhana. Or
yeah.
When in your practice have you had the most profound sense of sort of that anicca is part of the fabric of the universe?
Yeah. Right. Probably the first time was on retreat with Ayakema back in 1991. And she put me to work noticing the arising and passing of phenomena. So she said, all right, step through the jhanas and then pay attention to the arising and passing of phenomena. So just simply open up your senses and notice whatever's arising and whatever's passing. So until the bell rings, I'm noticing sounds arising and passing. I'm noticing body sensations arising and passing. Thoughts arising and passing. The breathing arising and passing. Occasionally a smell arising and passing. The bell rings, and then there's a lot more arising and passing. The change of posture, the putting on my shoes, the going outside. All the visual field changes that are happening, as well as different sounds and everything else. So again, I'm just paying attention to arising and passing. Go eat. There's a whole lot of arising and passing and eating. And so just staying focused on arising and passing until I came back and sat down to meditate again, and then forget about arising and passing, step through the jhanas, and then back to arising and passing. So that was a really profound way of thinking about it, experiencing it. That practice in particular. The first time I read this book, it hit me in a different way. Yeah, you read a book and it comes at you intellectually, but this actually touched me quite deeply. And so sometimes just something like reading this. Joseph Goldstein's talk where he said, think of yourself as a verb, not a noun. And the follow-up contemplation of that until I was seeing the whole universe as nothing but verbs, and then finally seeing there was only one verb, the unfolding. So that was the contemplation. Now, that contemplation was often being done as I would meditate, step through the jhanas, and then think about, okay, what does it mean for me to be a verb? And then all that other stuff followed on from that over time. So contemplating the nature, as well as just going out and experiencing it. Those were, I guess, the ways that it was most profound.
When I was 17, I was visiting a really good friend that was in a semi-coma. Came out of the semi-coma, looked at me, squinting eyes, and said, John, nothing is as it seems. And then died.
Wow.
And that's,
yeah.
That's funny out.
Yeah, I bet.
And it was about 10 years later that I was in a situation and it came back. I mean, that went dormant for a while. It never went away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm beginning to get what that means.
Yeah, it's really profound. Yeah, things are not what they seem to be. They're not even things. They're verbs.
I said no thing. Those are the end of it.
Yeah, no thing is what it seems to be. Yeah.
Why is it always referred to as arising and passing? Why not just say changing in the suttas, especially?
I think there's the point of noticing that we notice something arising, and then we notice something passing. And then it's changing in between the arising and the passing. So it's really trying to delineate that things have an origin and a cessation. And while they're around, they're changing. So I think that's why this is being pointed to like that.
So what about arising in consciousness
and leaving consciousness? That and arising in existence and leaving existence. Like, there was one of those brownies that arose into existence and I latched onto it and it ceased to exist. So it was, arising in my consciousness, but it was also rising in the material world and ceasing in the material world. So I think it's both that are actually important.
So all of this is pointing at emptiness.
Mm-hmm. When you really see any of the three characteristics, you wind up seeing the other two as well. So when you see that everything is changing, nothing is staying the same, it's empty. It doesn't have an essence. If something had an essence, it would always maintain that essence. Right? The essence wouldn't go away. Otherwise, it wouldn't be an essence. Right? So the fact that everything is changing is also pointing to the fact that nothing has an essence. In other words, it's empty. Everything, it turns out, is dependent on other things, which is what the depth of the teaching on emptiness is. And it's all because nothing is solid and stationary. It's all just arising dependent on other things. The way I usually put it is there's nothing but streams of dependently originated phenomena interacting. It's a very dynamic situation. There's nothing but streams of dependently originated phenomena interacting. I'll probably say it again and again. We'll talk about dependent origination in a couple nights. It'll probably come up then.
It seemed to me from the beginning that almost any teaching in the Dhamma is a hologram for the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's definitely true of the Eightfold Path or really any of it.
Yeah, if you dig down deeply enough, you find the whole thing anywhere you start. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a really brilliant set of teachings. Yeah. Okay, so we'll take a short break and then do metta.